In the middle of the open page there was a familiar face. A man with burning eyes whose head wore the branching antlers of a stag. Simon looked up at the room, then back to the book. He was in Morgani's chambers, of course. Of course! Where had he thought he was? Even as the realization came to him, as the silhouettes took on the familiar shapes of the doctor's flasks and racks and retorts, there was a cautious scraping noise at the door. He started at the unexpected sound. Diagonal stripes of moonlight made the wall seem to lean crazily. The scraping came again.
Simon!
The voice was very quiet, as though the speaker did not wish to be heard, but he recognized it instantly.
Doctor?
He leaped to his feet and crossed to the door in a few steps. Why hadn't the old man knocked? And what was he doing coming back so late? Perhaps he had been away on some mysterious journey and had foolishly locked himself out. That was it, of course. Lucky that Simon was there to let him in. He fumbled with the shadowy latch.
What have you been up to, Dr. Morganis?
He whispered.
I have been waiting for you for such a long time.
There was no answer. Even as he worked the bolt from the slot, he was filled with a sudden sense of unease. He stopped with the door half unbarred, standing on his tiptoes to peer down through a crack between the boards.
Doctor?
In the inner passageway, splashed in the blue light of the hall lamps, the old man's hooded, cloaked form stood before the door. His face was shadowed, but there was no mistaking his tattered old cloak, his slight build, the wisps of white hair that straggled from his hood, blue-tinted in the lamp glow.
Why wouldn't he answer? Was he hurt? Are you all right?
Simon asked, swinging the door inward. The small, bowed figure did not move.
Where have you been? What have you found out?
He thought he heard the doctor say something, and bent forward.
What?
The words that rose up to him were full of air, painfully harsh.
False messenger?
Was all he understood. The dry voice seemed to labor at speech, and then the face tilted up, and the hood fell back. The head that wore the ragged fringe of white hair was a burnt, blackened ruin. A knob with cracked, empty pits for eyes, the spindly neck on which it wobbled, a charred stick. Even as Simon staggered away, an unfreeable scream lodged in his throat. A thin red line spread across the front of the black, leathery ball. An instant later, the mouth yawned open, a split grin of pink meat.
The false messenger,
it said, each word a rustling gasp.
Beware!
And then Simon did scream, until the blood pounded in his ears, for the burned thing spoke, beyond a doubt, with the voice of Dr. Morganis. His speeding heart took a long time to slow. He sat breathing raggedly, and Binnebik sat beside him.
There is nothing of harm here, the troll said,
then pressed his palm against Simon's forehead.
You are chilled.
Jaloi strode back from the pallet where she had replaced Malachi's blanket, kicked free when Simon's cry had startled him awake.
You had powerful dreams like this when you lived at the castle, boy?
She asked, fixing him with a stern eye as if daring him to deny it. Simon shivered. Faced with that overwhelming gaze, he felt no urge to tell anything but the truth.
Not until the last few months before...
Before Morganis died, said Jaloi flatly. Binnebik, unless the learning I have has deserted me completely, I cannot believe this is chance. For him to dream of Morganis in my house. Not a dream like that.
Binnebik ran a hand through his own sleep-tousled hair.
Valara Jaloi, if you do not know, how can I? Daughter of the mountains, I feel that I am listening to noises in the dark. I cannot make out the dangers that surround us. But dangers, I know they are. Simon dreams of a warning against false messengers. But that is one only of too many mysterious things. Why the Norns? The Black Rimmer's men? The filthy Buchan?
Jaloi turned to Simon and gently but forcefully pushed him back onto his cloak.
Try and go back to sleep, she said. Nothing will enter the house of the witch woman that can harm you.
She turned to Binnabik.
I think if the dreaming he has described is as coherent as it seems, he will be of use in our search for answers.
Lying on his back, Simon saw the Valada and the troll as black shapes against the firefly gleam of the embers. The smaller shadow leaned close to him.
Simon, Binnabik whispered, are there any other dreamings that have been left out, that you have not told?
Simon slowly wagged his head from side to side. There was nothing. Nothing but shadows. And he was tired of talking. He could still taste the fear from the burned thing in the doorway. He only wanted to surrender to the sucking pull of oblivion. To sleep. To sleep. But it did not come so easily. Although he held his eyes tightly closed, still the images of fire and catastrophe rose before him. Tossing in place, unable to find a position that would encourage his tight muscles to loosen, he heard the quiet talk of the troll and the witch woman scratch away like rats in the walls. Finally, even that noise ceased, and the solemn breathing of the wind rose again in his ears. He opened his eyes. Jaloi was sitting alone before the fire, shoulders up like a bird huddling from the rain, eyes half open. He could not tell if she was sleeping or watching the fire smolder out. His last waking thought, which rose slowly up from deep inside him, flickering as it came like a fire beneath the sea, was of a tall hill, a hill crowned with stones. That had been in a dream, hadn't it? He should have remembered, should have told Binnabik. A fire sprang up in the darkness of the hilltop, and he heard the creaking of wooden wheels, the wheels of dream. When morning came, it did not bring the sun with it. From the window of the cottage, Simon could see the dark treetops at the far edge of the bowl, but the lake itself wore a thick cloak of fog. Even directly below the window, the water was hard to see, slowly swirling mist, making all things hazy and insubstantial. Above the top of the murky tree line, the sky was a depthless grey. Jaloi had marched the boy Malachias out with her to gather a certain healing moss, leaving Binnabik behind to tend to Leleth. The troll seemed faintly encouraged about the child's condition, but when Simon looked at her pale face and the faint movements of her small chest, he wondered what difference the little man could see that he could not. Simon rebuilt the fire from a pile of dead branches that Jaloi had stacked neatly in the corner, then went to help change the girl's dressings. As Binnabik peeled the sheet back from Leleth's body and lifted away the bandages, Simon winced, but would not let himself turn away. Her whole torso was blackened by bruises and ugly tooth marks. The skin had been torn from under her left arm to her hip, a ragged slash a foot long. As Binnabik finished cleaning the wound and bound her up again with broad strips of linen, little roses of blood bloomed through the cloth. "Does she really have a chance to live?" Simon asked. Binnabik shrugged, his hands engaged in the making of careful knots.
"Jaloi thinks she may," he said. "She is a woman of a stern and direct mind, who places people not above animals in her esteem. But that is still esteem most high. She would not struggle against the impossible, I am thinking."
"Is she really a witch woman, like she said?"
Binnabik pulled the sheet up over the little girl, leaving only her thin face exposed. Her mouth was partly open. Simon could see that she had lost both her front teeth. He felt a sudden, bitter ache of empathy for the child, lost with only her brother in the wild forest, captured and tormented, frightened. How could the Lord Usiris love such a world?
"A witch woman?"
Binnabik stood up. Outside, Kantaka clattered up the front door bridge, Jaloi and Malachias would be close behind.
A wise woman, she certainly is, and a being of rare strength. In your tongue, I understand witch to mean a bad person, one who is of your devil and does her neighbors harm. That the Valada is certainly not. Her neighbors are the birds and the forest dwellers, and she tends them like a flock. Still, she was leaving Rimmersgard many years ago, many, many years ago, to come here. Possible it is that the people who once lived around her thought some nonsense as that. Perhaps that was the cause of her coming to this lake.
Benebik turned to greet the impatient Kantaka, scratching through the deep fur of her back as she wriggled in pleasure, then took a pot out to the front door and lowered it down into the water. Returning, he hung it on a hooked chain over the fire.
You have known Malachias from the castle, you said?
Simon was watching Kantaka. The wolf had trotted back down to the lake and was standing in the shallows, lunging at the water with her snout. Is she trying to catch fish? He asked, laughing. Benebik smiled patiently and nodded.
And catch them, she can do too. Malachias.
Oh, yes, I knew him there, a little. I caught him once spying on me. He denied it, though. Did he speak to you? Did he tell you what he and his sister were doing in Aldeorta? How they were captured?
Kantaka had indeed caught a fish, a shining silver thing that fluttered wildly but pointlessly as the wolf mounted onto the lake's edge, streaming with water.
More luck I would be having trying to teach a rock to sing.
Benebik found a bowl of dried leaves on one of Jaloi's shelves and crumbled a handful into the pot of boiling water. Instantly the room was full of warm, minty smells.
5 or 6 words I have heard from his mouth since we found them up in that tree. He remembers you, though. Several times I have seen him at staring at you. I think he is not dangerous. In fact, I have a real sureness of it. But still, he is in need of watching.
Before he could speak, Simon heard Kantaka give a short bark down below. He looked out the window in time to see the wolf spring up, her mostly devoured catch left on the lake shore, and bound away up the path. Within a moment she had disappeared into the mist. She soon came trotting back, followed by 2 dim shapes that gradually became Jaloi and the odd, fox-faced boy, Malachias. The 2 of them were talking animatedly.
Kinkipa!
Benebik snorted as he stirred the pot of water.
Now he is speaking.
As she scraped her boots at the doorway, Jaloi leaned her head inside.
Fog everywhere, she said. The forest is sleepy today.
She entered, shaking out her cloak, followed by Malachias, who again looked wary. The color was high in his cheeks. Jaloi went promptly to her table and began sorting out the contents of a pair of sacks. Today she was dressed like a man in thick wool breeches, a jerkin, and a pair of worn but sturdy boots. She exuded an air of calm force, like a war captain who had made all possible preparations, and now waited only for the battle to commence.
Is the water ready?
She asked. Benebik leaned over the pot and sniffed.
It is seeming to be,
he said after a moment.
Good.
Jaloi untied a small cloth bag from her belt and removed a handful of dark green moss, still shiny with beads of water. After dumping it unceremoniously into the pot, she stirred it with the stick Benebik had given her.
Malachias and I have been talking, she said, squinting down into the steam. We have spoken of many things.
She looked up, but Malachias only ducked his head, his pink cheeks even reddening a bit further, and went to sit beside Leleth on the pallet. He took her hand and stroked her pale, damp forehead. Jaloi shrugged.
Well, we
We shall speak when Malachias is ready. For now, we have tasks enough anyway.
She lifted some of the moss on the end of the stirring stick, poked it with her finger, then plucked a bowl from a small wooden table and scooped the whole sticky mess out of the pot. She carried the steaming bowl over to the mattress. While Malachias and the witch woman made poultices of the moss, Simon walked down to the lakeside. The outside of the witch woman's cottage looked quite as odd by daylight as the inside seemed by night. The thatched roof came to a point, like a strange hat, and the dark wood of the walls was covered all over in black and blue rune paintings. As he walked around the house and down to the shore, the letters disappeared and reappeared as the angle of the sun changed. Mired in the dark shadows beneath the hut, the twin stilts on which it stood also seemed covered with some kind of unusual shingles. Kantaka had returned to the carcass of her fish, delicately worrying the last bits of meat loose from the slender bones. Simon sat beside her on a rock, then moved a bit farther away in response to her warning growl. He threw pebbles out into the swallowing mist, listening for the splash, until Binnebik came down to join him.
"Break your fasting?"
the troll asked, handing him a knob of crusty dark bread, liberally smeared with pungent cheese. Simon ate it quickly. Then they sat and watched a few birds, picking in the sand at the lakeshore.
"Valara Jaloi would like you to join us, to be part of the thing we are to be doing this afternoon,"
Benedict said at last.
"What thing?"
"Searching. Searching answers."
"Searching how? Are we going somewhere?"
Benedict looked at him seriously.
"In some way, yes. No, do not be looking so cross. I will explain."
He cast a pebble.
"There is a thing that is done sometimes when ways of finding things out are closed. A thing that the wise can do. My master Oke Cook called it walking the road of dreams."
"But that killed him."
"No. That is to say..."
The troll's expression was worried as he searched for words.
"It is to say, yes, he died while on the road. But a man may die on any road. That is not meaning that anyone who walks upon it will be dying. People have been crushed by carts in your main row, but hundreds of others walk upon it every day without harm."
"What exactly is the road of dreams?"
Simon asked.
"I must first admit,"
Binnebik said with a sad half-smile,
"that the dream road is more dangerous than main row. I was taught by my master that this road is like a mountain path, higher than any others."
The troll lifted his hand in the air above his own head.
"From this road, although the climbing of it has great difficulty, you can see things that never otherwise would you have seen. Things that from the road of every day would be invisible."
"And the dream part?"
"I was taught that by dreaming is one way to mount up to this road, one any person can do."
Benedict furrowed his brow.
"But when a person reaches to the road by ordinary night dreaming, he cannot then be walking along the road. He sees from one spot only, and then must come back down. So, Uke Cook told to me, this one does not often know what he is looking at. Sometimes..."
He gestured out at the mist that clung to the trees and lake.
"It is only fog that he sees. The wise one, though, can be walking along the road. Once he has mastered the art of climbing to it, he can be walking and looking, seeing things as they are, as they change."
He shrugged.
"Explaining is difficult, The Dream Road is a place to go and see things that cannot be seen clearly where we stand beneath the waking sun. Jaloi is a veteran of this journey. I have been given some experience of it myself, although I am no master.
Simon sat staring quietly out across the water for a while, thinking about Binnabik's words. The lake's other shore was invisible. He wondered idly how far away across the water it was. His tired memories of their arrival the day before were as hazy as the morning air.
Now that I come to think of it, he realized, how far have I come? A long way. Farther than I thought I would ever travel. And still have many leagues to go, I'm sure. Is it worth the risk to better our chances of reaching Naglamund alive?
Why had such decisions fallen on him? It really was horribly unfair. He wondered bitterly why God had picked him out for such mistreatment. If indeed it was true, as Father Dreyosen used to say, that he kept his eye on everyone. But there was more to think about than just his anger. Binnabik and the others seemed to be counting on him, and that was something Simon was not used to. Things were expected of him now.
I'll do it, he said finally. But tell me one thing. What really happened to your master? Why did he die?
Binnabik slowly nodded his head.
I am told that there are two ways that things can happen on the road. Things that are dangerous. The first, and it is usually happening only to the unskilled, is that if one tries to walk the road without proper wisdom, it is possible to miss the places where the Dream Road and the track of earthbound life go separate ways.
He skewed the palms of his hands.
The walker then cannot locate the way back. But, okay, Cook, I am thinking, was far too wise for that.
Going lost and homeless in those imagined realms touched a responsive point in Simon, and he sucked in a breath of damp air.
Then what happened to Uke Cook?
The other danger he was teaching me, Binnabik said as he stood up, was that there are other things beside the wise and the good that roam upon the road of dreams, and other dreamers of a more dangerous sort. It is my thinking that he met one of these.
Binnabik led Simon up the little ramp into the cottage. Jaloi unstoppered a wide pot and stuck two fingers in, bringing them out covered with a dark green paste even stickier and stranger smelling than the moss poultice.
Lean forward, she said, and wiped a gob of it on Simon's forehead just above his nose, then did the same for herself and Binnabik.
What is it?
Simon asked. It felt strange on his skin, both hot and cold. Jaloi settled herself before the sunken fire and gestured for the boy and troll to join her.
Nightshade, mock foil, whitewood bark to give it the proper consistency.
She ranged the boy, the troll, and herself around the fireplace in a triangle, placing the pot on the floor by her knee. The sensation on his forehead was most curious, Simon decided as he watched the Valada throw green twigs onto the fire. White streamers of smoke went writhing upward, turning the space between them into a misty column through which her sulphurous eyes glowed, reflecting the firelight.
Now, rub this on both your hands, she said, scooping out another gobbet for each of them, and a dab on your lips, but not in your mouth. Just a dab. There.
When all was finished, she had them reach out and join hands. Malachias, who had not spoken since Simon and the troll had returned, watched from the pallet beside the sleeping child. The strange boy looked tense, but his mouth was set in a grim line, as though he willed himself to keep his nervousness hidden. Simon stretched his arms out on both sides, clasping Binnabik's small dry paw in his own left hand and Jaloi's sturdy one in his right.
Hold tightly,
the witch woman said,
There is nothing terrible that will happen if you let go, but it will be better if you hold on.
She cast her eyes down and began to speak softly, the words inaudible. Simon stared at her moving lips, at the drooping lids of her wide eyes. Again he was struck by how much she resembled a bird, a proud, steep-soaring bird at that. As he continued to gaze through the column of smoke, the tingling on his palms, forehead, and lips began to bother him. Darkness was suddenly all around, as though a dense cloud had passed before the sun. In a moment he could see nothing but the smoke and the red fire glow beneath it. All else had disappeared into the walls of blackness that loomed up on either side. His eyes were heavy, and at the same time he felt as though someone had pushed his face down in snow. He was cold. Very cold. He fell backward, toppling, and the blackness was all around him. After a time, and Simon had no idea how long it might have been, only that through it all he could still faintly feel the grip on both his hands, a very reassuring sensation, the darkness began to glow with a directionless light, a light that gradually resolved itself into a field of white. The whiteness was uneven. Some parts of it shone like sunlight on polished steel. Other places were almost grey. A moment later, the field of white became a vast, glittering mountain of ice. A mountain so impossibly tall that its head was hidden in the swirling clouds lining the dark sky. Smoke belched from crevices in its glassy sides and streamed upward to join the cloud halo. And then somehow, he was inside the great mountain, flying as rapidly as a spark through tunnels that led ever inward, dark tunnels that were nevertheless lined with mirroring ice. Uncountable thousands of shapes made their way through the mists and shadows and frost gleam. Pale-faced, angular shapes who marched the corridors in moving thickets of glimmering spears, or tended the strange blue and yellow fires whose smokes crowned the heights above. The spark that was Simon still felt two firm hands grasping his own, or rather felt something else that told him he was not alone, for certainly a spark could have no hands to hold. He was at last in a great chamber, a vast hollow in the mountain's center. The roof was so high above the ice-glazed tiles of the floor that snow flurried down from its upper reaches, leaping, whirling clouds of snow like armies of tiny white butterflies. In the center of the immense chamber was a monstrous well, whose mouth flickered with pale blue light, and which seemed the source of a hideous, heart-squeezing fear. Some heat must have been floating up from its unguessable depths, for the air above it was a roiling pillar of fogs, a misty column gleaming with diffuse colors, like a Titan icicle catching the sun's light. Hanging somehow in the fog above the well, its shape not quite clear, or its dimensions entirely guessable, was an inexplicable something, a thing made up of many things and many shapes, all colorless as glass. It seemed, as its lineaments appeared here and there in the swirling mist pillar, a creation of angles and sweeping curves, of subtle frightening complexity. In some not quite definable way, it seemed an instrument of music. If so, it was an instrument so huge, alien, and frightening that the spark that was Simon knew he could never hear its awful music and live. Facing the well, in an angular seat of rime-crusted black rock, a figure sat. He could see it clearly, as though suddenly he hovered directly over the terrible blue-burning well. It was cloaked in a white and silver robe of fantastic intricacy. Snowy hair streamed down over its shoulders, to blend almost invisibly with the immaculate white garments. The pale form lifted its head, and the face was a mass of shining light. A moment later, as it turned away again, he could see that it was only a beautiful, expressionless sculpture of a woman's face, a mask of silver. The dazzling, exotic face turned back toward him. He felt himself pushed away, brusquely disconnected from the scene like a clinging kitten being pulled free from the hem of a dress. A vision swam up before him that was somehow a part of the wreath of fogs and the grim white figure. At first it was only another patch of alabaster whiteness. Gradually it became an angular shape, crisscrossed with black. The black shapes became lines, the lines became symbols. At last an open book hung before him. On its open page were letters Simon could not read, twisting runes that wavered and then came clear. A timeless instant passed. Then the runes began to shimmer once more. They pulled apart and reformed themselves into black silhouettes, three long, slender shapes, three swords. One had a hilt shaped like the tree of Osiris. Another, a hilt like the right-angle crossbeams of a roof. The third had a strange double guard, the crosspieces making with the hilt a sort of five-pointed star. Somewhere, deep in Simon's self, he recognized this last sword. Somewhere, in a memory black as night, deep as a cave, he had seen such a blade. The swords began to disappear one by one, and when they were gone, only gray and white nothingness was left. Simon felt himself falling back, away from the mountain, away from the well chamber, away from the dream itself. A part of him welcomed this falling away, horrified by the terrible, forbidden places where his spirit had flown. But another part of him did not want to let go. Where were the answers? His whole life had been caught up, snagged by the passage of some damnable, remorseless, uncaring wheel. And deep in the part of himself that was most private, he was desperately angry. He was frightened, too, trapped in a nightmare that would not end. But what he felt now was the anger. At that moment, it was the stronger. He resisted the pull, fighting with weapons he did not understand, to retain the dream, to wring from it the knowledge he wanted. He seized the fast diminishing whiteness and furiously tried to mold it, to make it into something that would tell him why Morghenis had died, why Dokais and the monks of St. Hodorun's had perished, why the little girl Leleth lay close to death in a hut in the depths of the wild forest. He struggled and he hated. If a spark could weep, he wept. Slowly, painfully, the ice mountain formed again from the blankness before him. Where was the truth? He wanted answers. As Simon's dream self struggled, the mountain grew taller, grew more slender, began sprouting branches like an icy tree as it reached into the heavens. Then the branches fell away, and it was only a smooth white tower. A tower that he knew. Flames burned at its summit. A great booming sound came, like the tolling of a monstrous bell. The tower wavered. The bell thundered again. This was something of dreadful importance, he knew, something ghastly, something secret. He could feel an answer almost within reach.
Little fly, you have come to us, have you?
A horrible, searing black nothingness reached up and engulfed him, blocking out the tower and the sounding bell. He felt the breath of life burning away inside his dream self, as infinite coldness closed around him. He was lost in the screamingly empty void, a tiny speck at the bottom of a sea of infinite black depths, cut free from life, breath, thought. Everything had vanished. Everything except the horrible, crushing hatred of the thing that gripped him, smothered him. And then, beyond all hope, he was free. He was soaring, dizzyingly high above the world of Ostenard, clutched in the strong talons of a large grey owl, flying like the wind's own child. The ice mountain was disappearing behind him, swallowed up in the immensity of the bone-white plain. In impossibly swift moments, the owl carried him away, over lakes and ice and mountains, winging toward a dark line on the horizon. Just as it came clear to him, as the line became a forest, he felt himself beginning to slip from the owl's claws. The bird clutched him tighter and dropped earthward in a whistling dive. The ground leaped up, and the owl spread her wide wings. They flattened out, gliding, and whirled across the snowfields toward the security of the forest. And then they were under the eaves and safe. Simon groaned and rolled over onto his side. His head was pounding like Reuben the Bear's anvil during tournament time. His tongue seemed swollen to twice its normal size. The air he breathed tasted of metal. He pulled himself into a crouch, moving his heavy head as slowly as possible. Binnebik was lying nearby, his wide face pale. Kantaka nosed at the troll's side, whimpering. Across the smoking fireplace, dark-haired Malachias was shaking Jaloi, whose mouth hung slack, her lips gleaming wetly. Simon groaned again as his head throbbed, hanging down between his shoulders like a bruised fruit. He crawled to Binnebik. The little man was breathing. Even as Simon leaned over him, the troll began to cough, gasped for air, and opened his eyes.
"We," he rasped, "we are all here?"
Simon nodded, looking over to Jaloi, still motionless despite Malachi's attentions.
"A moment," he said,
then slowly got to his feet. He walked gingerly out the hut's front door, carrying a small empty pot. He was faintly surprised to see that despite the pall of fog, it was still full afternoon. The time on the dream road had seemed much longer than that. He also had the nagging feeling that something else had changed outside the cottage, but could not put his finger on what the difference was. The view seemed slightly off. He decided it must be some effect of his experience. After filling the pot with lake water and washing the sticky green paste from his hands, he returned to the house. Binnebik drank thirstily, then gestured that Simon should take the container to Jaloi. Malachias watched, half hopeful, half jealous, as Simon carefully took the witch woman's jaw in one hand and splashed a little water into her open mouth. She coughed, then swallowed, and Simon gave her a little more. As he held her head, Simon was suddenly aware that in some way Jaloi had saved him while they were all walking in dream. As he looked down at the woman, who was breathing more regularly now, he remembered the grey owl who had caught him up when his dream self had been at its final gasp and had borne him away. Jaloi and the troll had not expected quite such a circumstance, he sensed. In fact, it was Simon who had put them in such danger. For once, though, he had no feelings of shame over his actions. He had done what needed doing. He had been fleeing the wheel long enough.
"How is she?"
Binnebik asked.
"I think she will be well," Simon replied, looking at the witch woman carefully. "She saved me, didn't she?"
Binnebik stared for a moment. Hair hung in sweaty spikes on his brown forehead.
"It is likely that she did," he said finally. "She is a powerful ally, but even her strength has been by this taxed to the limit."
"What did it mean?"
Simon asked now, releasing Jaloi to the supporting arms of Malachias.
"Did you see what I saw? The mountain and the lady with the mask?
And the book?" "I wonder if we saw all things the same, Simon,"
Binnebik answered slowly.
"But I am thinking it is important we wait until Jaloi can share her thoughts with us. Perhaps later, when we have eaten. I am full of terrible hunger."
Simon gave the troll a shaky half-smile and turned to find Malachias staring at him. The boy started to turn away, then seemed to find some internal resolution and held his stare, until it was Simon who began to feel uncomfortable.
"It was as if the whole house was shaking,"
Malachias said abruptly, startling Simon more than a little. The boy's voice was strained, high-pitched and hoarse.
"What do you mean?"
Simon asked, fascinated as much by the fact of Malachi's speaking as by what he said.
"The whole cottage. while you three sat and stared at the fire, the walls began to quiver, like someone picked it up and set it down again. Most likely it was only the way we were moving while we were... I mean, oh, I don't know.
Simon gave up in disgust. The truth was he didn't really know anything right at this moment. His brains felt as though they'd been stirred with a stick. Malachias turned away to give more water to Jaloi. Raindrops suddenly began to patter down onto the windowsill. The grey sky could hold back its burden of storm no longer. The witch woman was grim. They had pushed aside the soup bowls and sat facing each other on the bare floor. Simon, the troll, and the mistress of the cottage. Malachias, although obviously interested, remained on the bed beside the little girl.
"I saw evil things moving," Jaloi said,
and her eyes flashed.
"Evil things that will shake the roots of the world, we know."
She had recovered her strength. And something else. She was solemn and grave as a king in judgment.
"I almost wish we had not taken the dream path. But that is an idle wish from the part of me that wants just to be left alone. I see darker days coming, and I fear to be drawn in by events so ill-omened."
"What do you mean?" Simon asked. "What was all that? Did you see the mountain too?"
"Storm spike."
Benedict's voice was strangely flat. Jaloi looked over at him, nodded, then turned back to Simon.
"True. It was storm spike we saw, as they call it in Rimmersgard, where it is a legend, as far as Rimmer's men are concerned. Storm spike. The mountain of the Norns." "We cannot," Benedict said. "No storm spike to be real. But still, the Norns have not been intruding on the affairs of Austin Ard since time beyond time. Why now? It looked to me as if...
"As if they were preparing for war," Jaloi finished for him.
"You are right, if the dream is to be trusted."
"Whether it was true seeing, of course, would take a better trained eye than even mine. But you said the hounds that pursue you were the brand of Stormspike. That is real evidence in the waking world. I think we can trust this part of the dream. Or at least I think we ought to."
"Preparing for war?"
Simon was already confused.
"Against who? And who was the woman in the silver mask?"
Jaloi looked very tired.
"The mask, not a woman. A creature out of legend, you could say. Or a creature out of time, beyond time, as Benedict put it. That was Otoko, the queen of the Norns."
Simon felt a chill sweep over him. The wind outside sang a cold and lonely song.
"But what are these Norns? Benedict said they were Scythi."
"The old wisdom says that they were part of the Scythi once,"
Jaloi responded.
"But they are a lost tribe, or renegades. They never came to Aswa with the rest of their folk, but disappeared into the unmapped north, the icy lands beyond Rimmersgard and its mountains. They chose to separate themselves from the doings of Austin Ard, although that seems to be changing."
For a moment, Simon saw a flicker of deep unease cross the witch woman's sour, practical face.
"And these Norns are helping Elias chase me?" he thought, feeling panic rise again. "Why am I sunk in this nightmare?"
Then, as if his fright had opened a door in his mind, he remembered something. Unpleasant shapes climbed up from the hidden places in his heart, and he struggled to catch his breath.
Those pale people, the Norns. I've seen them before.
What?
Jaloi and the troll spoke at the same time, leaning forward. Simon, startled by their intensity, backed away.
When?
Jaloi snapped.
It happened. I think it happened. It may have been a dream. On the night I ran away from the Hayholt. I was in the lich yard, and I thought I heard something calling my name, a woman's voice. I was so frightened that I ran away, out of the lich yard and toward Thistleborg.
There was a stirring on the pallet, Malachias nervously shifting position. Simon ignored him and continued.
There was a fire on top of Thistleborg, up among the anchor stones. Do you know them?
I do.
Jaloi's response was matter of fact, but Simon sensed some weight behind the words he did not understand.
Well, I was cold and frightened, so I climbed up. I'm sorry, but I was so sure that this was a dream. Perhaps it is.
Perhaps. Go on.
There were men on the top. They were soldiers. I could tell because they wore armor.
Simon felt a thin sweat break on his palms and rubbed them together.
One of them was King Elias. I was frightened even more then, so I hid. Then there was a horrible creaking noise, and a black wagon came up the far side of the hill.
It was coming back, all coming back. Or at least it seemed like all. But there were still empty shadows.
Those pale-skinned people. The Norns, that's what they were. Were with it, several of them, dressed in black robes.
There was a long pause while Simon struggled to remember. Rain drummed on the cottage roof.
And?
The Valada asked at last, gently.
Elysium, Mother of God,
Simon swore, and tears started in his eyes.
I can't remember. They gave him something, something from the wagon. Other things happened too, but it feels like it's all under a blanket in my head. I can touch it, but I can't tell what it is. They gave him something. I thought it was a dream.
He buried his face in his hands, trying to squeeze the painful thoughts from his whirling head.
Binnabik awkwardly patted Simon's knee.
This is perhaps answering our other question. I too pondered over why the Norns should be readying for battle. I wondered if they would be fighting against Elias, the High King, as some age-old grievance against mankind. Now it has the appearance to me that they are helping him. Some kind of bargain has been struck. Possibly it was that which Simon saw. But how? How could Elias ever make such compact with the secretive Norns?
Priorities.
As soon as Simon said it, he was sure it was true.
Morgani said that Priorities opened doors, and the terrible things came through.
Priorities was on that hill, too.
Valada Jaloi nodded her head.
It makes a kind of sense. A question that must be answered, but one that I am sure is beyond our powers, is, what was the bargaining tally? What could these two Priorities and the king have to offer to the Norns for their aid?
They shared a long silence.
What did the book say? Simon asked abruptly. On the dream road. Did you see the book too?
Binnabik thumped the heel of his hand against his chest.
It was there. The runes. I saw what of Rimmersgard. Those far than weird. In your speech it means the spell of the swords.
Or weird of the swords,
Jaloi added.
It is a famous book in the circles of the wise, but it has been long lost. I have never seen it. It is said to have been written by Nises, a priest, who was a counselor to King Hjeldin the Mad.
The one Hjeldin's tower is named after?
Simon asked her.
Yes, that is where Hjeldin and Nises both died.
Simon considered. I saw three swords, too.
Binnabik looked to Jaloi.
Only shapes was I seeing.
the troll said slowly.
I thought they might have the look of swords.
The witch woman had not been sure either. Simon described the silhouettes, but they meant nothing to her or to Benabek.
So,
the little man said at last,
we have learned what from the Dream Road? That the Norns are giving aid to Elias, this wee guest? That a strange book is playing some part? Perhaps this is a new thing. We are given a dream glimpse of Storm Spike and the halls of the Mountain's Queen. We may have learned things that we do not understand yet. Still, I am thinking, one thing has changed not at all. We must take ourselves to Neglimund. Valada, your house will be protection for a while. But if Joshua lives, he has need to know of these things.
Benevik was interrupted from an unexpected quarter.
Simon, Malachias said, you said someone called you in the lich yard. It was my voice you heard. I was the one calling you.
Simon could only gape. Jaloi smiled.
At last one of our mysteries begins to speak. Go on, child, tell them what you must.
Malachias blushed furiously.
My name is not
Malachias. It is Maria.
But Maria is a girl's name, Simon began, then broke off at the sight of Jaloi's widening grin.
A girl? He said lamely.
He stared at the strange boy's face and suddenly saw it for what it was.
A girl,
he grunted, feeling impossibly stupid. The witch woman chuckled.
It was obvious, I must say, or it should have been. She had the advantage of traveling with a troll and a boy, and the cloak of confusing, dangerous events. But I told her the deception could not last.
Especially not all the way to Neclement.
And that is where I must go.
Maria rubbed her eyes wearily.
I have an important message to bear to Prince Joshua from his niece, Miriam Mel. Please do not ask me what it is, for I may not tell you.
What of your sister?
Benabek asked.
She will not be able to travel for a long time.
He too squinted at the surprising Maria, as if trying to discover how he had been fooled. It did seem obvious now.
She is not my sister,
Maria said sadly.
Leleth was the princess handmaiden. We were very close. She was frightened to stay in the castle without me, and she was desperate to come along.
She looked down at the sleeping child.
I should never have brought her. I tried to pull her up into the tree before the dogs caught us. If I had only been stronger.
It is not clear, Jaloi broke in, whether the little girl will ever be able to travel. She has not moved far from the brink of death. I am sorry to say it, but it is the truth.
You must leave her with me.
Maria started to protest, but Jaloi would not listen. Simon was disturbed to see what he thought was a glimmer of relief in the girl's dark eyes. It angered him to think she would leave the wounded child behind, no matter how important the message.
So,
Benabek said finally,
where is it we are now? We still must reach Neglimund, and we are blocked by leagues of forest and the steep slopes of Wealdhelm, not mentioning those who will be in our pursuit.
Jaloi thought carefully.
It seems clear to me, she said, that you must get through the forest to Die Chikiza. That is an old city place. Long deserted, of course. There you can find the Stille, which is an old road through the hills, from a time when the city regularly traveled between there and Aswa, the Heholt. It is unused now, except by animals, but it will be the easiest, safest place to cross.
I can give you a map in the morning. Yes, Dai Chikisa.
A deep light kindled in her yellow eyes, and she nodded her head slowly, as if lost in thought. A moment later she blinked, and became her brisk self once more.
Now you should sleep. We should all sleep. The day's doings have left me limp as a willow branch.
Simon didn't think so. He thought the witch woman looked strong as an oak tree, but he supposed even an oak could suffer in a storm. Later, as he lay curled in his cloak, the warm bulk of Kantaka's somewhat intrusive presence against his legs, he tried to push away thoughts of the terrible mountain. Such things were too vast, too murky. Instead, he wondered what Maria must think of him. A boy, Jaloi had called him. A boy who did not know what a girl looked like. But that was not fair. When had there been time to think about it? Why had she been spying in the hayholt? For the princess, perhaps? And if it had been Maria who called to him in the lich yard, why? How had she known his name? Why had she bothered to learn it? He didn't remember ever seeing her at the castle, or at least not as a girl. When he at last floated off into sleep, like a tiny boat pushed out onto a black ocean, he felt as though he pursued a receding light, a patch of brightness just out of reach. Outside the windows, rain covered the dark mirror of Jaloi's lake. Chapter 27. The Gossamer Towers. He tried to ignore the hand on his shoulder, but could not. Opening his eyes, he found the room still quite dark. Two angular siftings of stars, the only indication of where the windows stood.
Let me sleep, he moaned. It's too early.